Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with violinist Arabella Steinbacher. Having previously performed with the Philadelphia Orchestra at Saratoga and on its recent tour of Asia, she made her subscription concert debut this week. Susan Lewis considers Art in the Open, a new outdoor art festival about to open on the banks of the Schuylkill River in Center City, Philadelphia. We speak with James W. Hilty, author of Temple University, 125 Years of Service to Philadelphia, the Nation and the World, and as part of a series exploring overlooked events in local history, Tom Keels reports on the Miscianza, a citywide party held in Philadelphia during the War of Independence in honor of a British Army general. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The German-born violinist Arabella Steinbacher first came to public attention in 2004 when, at short notice, she substituted for an ailing Kyung-Hwa Chung to perform the Beethoven Violin Concerto with the Orchestra of Radio France under Sir Neville Mariner. Her continued success since is due in large part to her diverse and deep repertoire, which includes more than 30 violin concertos extending from the classical period to the works of 20th century composers like Barber, Berg, Prokofiev and Stravinsky. Arabella Steinbacher has a growing reputation as a soloist in recitals and chamber music performances and with several highly acclaimed recordings. This week she made her Philadelphia Orchestra Kimmel Center debut, performing Mozart's Violin Concerto No. 5 in A Major. When we met on Tuesday, I first asked her why, when her mother was an opera singer and her father a pianist, she had taken up the violin.
Because I was very young, I was 3 years old, and my parents always tell me that I was quite wild and always running around, and they thought it would be good if I have something to do during the day, at least for 15 minutes. And yeah, so you can have very small violins. That's why my parents thought it would be a nice idea, but it was never really the idea behind it that I have to become a professional violinist.
And you were a Suzuki kid?
Sort of, yeah, because my mother is Japanese and there was a teacher who was just starting to teach Suzuki method. It was very new at that time in Germany. But he was German, so he did a mixture between Suzuki method and his own way of teaching.
And now you have a very, even still have a great ability to learn stuff by ear.
Yeah, I think it comes from that time, because in the beginning, of course, I couldn't read any music, and so I had to play what I heard. So my father played on the piano the melodies, and I had to imitate it. And today, yeah, it's strange, but I still learn the quickest way when I listen to the music, and not so much by reading.
And you have at any one time, I read, 20 concertos in your hands. I see that there's 31 on your website. How many concertos?
Probably there are more. I have never counted them, but Brahms, Beethoven, Mendelssohn.
All straight away, off the top of your head.
Yeah. I mean, most of the concertos if someone cancels tomorrow, then it was a standard repertoire. So of course, it's never a problem to, you know, just to take it out and to play it. But
And you're not a big practicer either, so it's not as if you're keeping these things fresh all the time.
No, but I play many different concertos in a season. I'm not one of the musicians who try to play always the same concerto during a period, which would be actually much more comfortable. But that keeps you also awake.
On your toes.
Yeah. But I try to play more similar concertos, especially when you're on tour. Then it's, much better if you have just one concerto and you play it several times. And I just had the situation a few days ago that I had to play a Beethoven concerto, and they had a cancellation in Dresden with the Staatskapelle. So I had only 2 days to practice it, and so I jumped in.
It worked out okay?
Yeah, Beethoven is okay. if it's not something like Alban Berg or Stravinsky or something, then, or Bartok, which is also takes a little bit more time.
You mentioned 20th century composers, and you seem to have a close affinity for the music of 20th century composers. You say Alban Berg, you really like his violin concerto.
Yeah, I love his concerto.
What is it about the 20th century then?
It's not really that I prefer much more to play it. I mean, it's just very much fun to play the works of the 20th century also because, very often it's just very wild. And I think I enjoy very much to put all the energy into it and just to let it go. And, with the other repertoire For example, like Beethoven or also especially Mozart, you have to be always very delicate and you have to be careful not to put too much aggression into it, otherwise it destroys the piece. Yeah, but I'd always try to have a contrast between the classic repertoire and the 20th century. You learn so much from the classic repertoire. It's much more difficult than a Shostakovich concerto or Prokofiev.
Or even a Berg.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, the Berg is different again. I mean, the Berg is also very delicate in a way. That's why I combined it actually with the Beethoven concerto on my disc, because I have the feeling they have something in common, even that they sound completely different.
Your career has kind of blossomed, has really flowered in the last 10 years. And you've had some great support. Some of it seems to have been a lot of talent and some luck as well. Are you somebody with a career plan? Do you say that in 2 years I want to have done this, or in 5 years I want to have done this? Are you ambitious in that way?
Not so much. Honestly, when I was still studying, I always wanted to play as a soloist with great orchestras and conductors, and that was always my dream. But I never really had a plan for that. I just tried to play the concerts which I got by that time, and then again new things developed from that and new contacts. So yeah, after a while it happened by itself that I got in contact to agencies and conductors, and they invited me to play with their orchestras, and so I can actually say it was a quite natural development, a very natural musical way. And also, I mean, by playing concerts you learn so much, because every concert is just completely different. It's never the same, not even when you're on tour and you play every night the same piece. It's just never the same, and you learn a lot about yourself. I think it's the biggest confrontation with yourself when you stand on stage, because there's no one who helps you, even if you're with the whole orchestra and with the conductor together on stage, you're still alone. And I think that's the best way of learning, just by doing it.
Arabella Steinbacher, the soloist for Mozart's Violin Concerto No. 5 in A Major with the Philadelphia Orchestra under Charles Dutoit. Performances are at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall this evening at 8, tomorrow afternoon at 2, and on Tuesday evening at 8.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
In plein air is a French expression used to describe the setting for artists working not in a studio, but in the great outdoors. Within the last half dozen years, plein air festivals have popped up in places like Arizona, Colorado, and California, as well as closer to home, like Wayne and suburban Philadelphia. Now, as Philadelphia offers its own version of an outdoor art-making festival, WRTI's Susan Lewis explores art in the open.
The Schuylkill, which takes its name from the old Dutch word meaning hidden river, travels through Philadelphia from the northwest down to where it meets the Delaware River south of the city. As it flows through Center City, crisscrossed in spots by bridges, its eponymous expressway runs along one bank, a recreational trail hugs the other. Bicyclists, runners, and walkers share the river's edge with geese and large turtles basking in the sun. This urban waterway seemed a natural fit for an outdoor art-making festival, says Art in the Open co-producer, arts programs planner Mary Salvante.
The Schuylkill River is such an important environmental feature in Philadelphia and had such a tremendous impact on the growth and success of the city over the years. There's open views, there's diversity in terms of the environment, the river versus the landscape, with the wonderful cityscape as a backdrop to that.
Most plein air events are painting festivals, but Salvante says she and her co-producers, artist Ed Bronstein and environmental planner Dina Loeb, wanted to reflect what was happening in the broader world of contemporary art.
And so we expanded that to include artists that were installation artists, sculptors, photographers, artists from all disciplines.
A jury of 5 curators chose 36 artists from among 111 applications. Some of those chosen, like artist Nancy Agati, who does installations, sculpture, and mixed media, have worked outside before and are, in fact, drawn to nature.
A lot of the work I've done outside has been directly related to the wind, to water. Right now, a project that I'm working on is based on a pattern of a leaf.
For this festival, Agati will set up near the Fairmount Waterworks and explore the movement of water over the waterfall and churning at the base of the dam.
One of the ideas I have is to make marks in silk, and that image in silk will be sort of suspended along the ground, floating above the ground. And the site that I've picked is very windy, so hopefully the wind will come across that and sort of blow the silk across, similar to the movement of the water.
The wide views presented by the river and its urban backdrop will offer good subjects for photographer Blaise Tobia, who often works to create a kind of panorama.
With at least 3, 4, 5, sometimes 20 images that are stitched together in order to give a very wide view. And for me, that's a lot like human vision, which doesn't really just stay fixed in a frame, but wanders around and looks at certain details and then moves again. And so I try to replicate that in the panoramic.
Tobia saw this festival invitation as something of a challenge, for while he often takes his photographs outdoors, completing his art usually happens in the dark.
It used to be a chemical dark room. Now it's kind of a dim room with a computer in it. So the idea came to me to bring the dark room out in the open, to basically bring the dark room into the light and to take my computer, take my printer, set up a little tent and be outdoors, doing the rest of the process that people don't generally see.
Letting the public see the creative process, says Mary Salvanti, is an important part of the festival concept.
And in turn, artists that are interested in these public festivals, this gives them a chance to be able to talk about their creative vision and what their inspiration is for that.
But how does having people around, even commenting, change the creative process? Nancy Agati says it may slow it down, but in a good way.
A lot of times when you're in your studio and you're by yourself, you have like a dialogue going on in your head about what you're doing, and you make those decisions inside. And this way, for me, it's an opportunity to take those words out of my head and tell them to perfect strangers who are walking by and get feedback from them. And maybe something they say is going to alter what I do.
I agree very much with Nancy on that. And being a public artist has a very public component. You really are trying to reach an audience. You're really trying to say something. So there'll be some immediate feedback here. I may do 2 or 3 versions of something and ask people for their opinions about which one they like and why.
The public is not the only variable influencing the work. Changeable weather, up to a point, can add to the possibilities for expression.
If it starts to rain, I might put out some plates of plexiglass and let it rain on them, and then dye them different colors and print them.
If it rains a little bit, sometimes it can be very beautiful. The effects of rain, the clouds coming over, and possibly even a rainbow after a storm, I mean, those are all things that photographers love.
The work of the 34 other selected artists spans a range of media, from drawing and painting, to sculpture and installation, to textiles, and an exploration of the musical dynamics of group knitting. There will also be a dance created by the Leahstein Dance Company. Even if they're not dancing, artists may move around and work at different times of day. Blaise Tobia plans to move his tent from spot to spot along the festival site. Each will create a work during the 4-day period, responding to the environment.
If you're right in Center City, Philadelphia, like around Market Street or Walnut Street, the way city planners worked in the 20s and 30s when that area was built was to not pay any attention to the river, to basically make it invisible so you drive over it and you don't even know you've driven over it. I'm going to work on making the river visible. You know, I'm going to be down at river level and I'm going to be attempting to show that the river is indeed a beautiful and valuable resource that moves through the heart of the city.
I've always been really drawn to the Schuylkill River. I enjoyed riding my bike down there, walking down there. But I think there is so much inspiration along that park, whether it's the industrial, whether it's the buildings, the architecture, the landscape, that I think there will be work that is across the board. It will not just be one thing.
On June 13th, at the end of the 4-day period, the work will be exhibited at the University of the Arts. The festival has also enlisted over 30 cultural organizations as program partners, which are hosting related exhibitions and workshops. Art in the Open aims to enlist the whole cultural community to foster a celebration and a better understanding of the relationship between art, the environment, and the quality of urban life.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Art in the Open's outdoor festival runs from Wednesday through Saturday. Related exhibitions include Art at City Hall and Waterwork at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. A complete list of events is at artintheopenphiladelphia.org. Temple University, now with 37,000 students, 8 campuses, 320 degree programs, educational partners all over the world, and hundreds of thousands of alumni, started in 1884 as a neighborhood school of higher education housed in a Baptist temple on North Broad Street. Its growth and role in the evolution of higher education and Philadelphia is chronicled by Temple history professor and former administrator James W. Hilty in Temple University, 125 Years of Service to Philadelphia, the Nation, and the World. This is, surprisingly, the first full history of the university since its founding by Russell Conwell, a New England-born Baptist minister, lawyer, and orator with a mission to democratize higher education. What Conwell called the Temple idea, to create a people's university, has endured and expanded as Temple sought to develop a relationship both with its North Philadelphia neighbors and people as far away as Rome and Tokyo. Earlier this week, James Hilty shared his thoughts with us about Temple's storied history and multifaceted approach to education, as well as its challenges for the future.
I've been at Temple for 40 years, and I've always been amazed that it's a university of great prestige and a long and impactful influence in Philadelphia, but no written history of it.
Really? Not even for the centenary?
No. Wow. No. In Russell Conwell's day, there was a kind of a running history made for the first 40 years of the university, and it was all in his lectures and his sermons, and he actually wrote a couple pieces for magazines explaining how Temple got started. It became more mythology than real history, however, and of course it was all wrapped up in Russell Conwell, the man. And in the 1980s, when I was working for Peter Liacouras and the president involved with strategic planning for the university, it occurred to me that the message of the university ought to be gotten out. And we made some strides in that regard, but it was really David Adamany that kind of lit the match and got a few of us together in the history department to begin looking at it as a problem. And then really Ann Hart and Weaver Hart, the current president, then decided for the 125th anniversary there ought to be some kind of a written record, finally put together a compilation of what the university means to the city, the region, the world, and what it really means to all the people who've been here for all these years.
It really is a sprawling organization in that you can be involved with this institution and not so much the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing. You can be on the tip of the index finger of the left hand and not know what's happening in any other part of the body. You clearly had to get a better handle on that. What changed in your mind about how you saw the university as you proceeded to write this book?
I think I became prouder of the university as I wrote and as I compiled and put together and pulled together. And I realized over the years that as a faculty member, and I'd been in and out of administrative positions over the course of 40 years, but like you said, you know, there were a lot of many little things that were going on and trying to grab them and pull them together. So I was looking for themes that essentially made Temple stand out and made Temple really unique. And it goes back to the founder, I think. It goes back to the democratization of higher education, the accessibility that Temple offers to people who would not normally get access to higher education. Those things are Temple's major contribution, not only to Philadelphia, but really to the world at large. And there have been many emulators of what Russell Conwell called the Temple idea. One of my favorite stories is that Conwell never was able to land that huge transition-shaping gift. He went to John D. Rockefeller, he went to William Bucknell, he went to Andrew Carnegie, he appealed and was, in fact, very appealing to many of these people who liked him personally and would give him personal sums, but never enough to really transition the university. He worked and struggled for so many years to make that happen, and yet what comes out of all is this notion that it's really a people's university, which is what he called it in 1895 in some of the very first ads about the university. He began to talk about how this was a university intended for the working men and women and their children of Philadelphia. And when you talk about being a commuter school, of course, for those first 20 years or so of its existence, it was really commuting by walking or bicycling from work or from home. It was really a very local institution at first, before there were subways and regional rail lines and even before there were automobiles.
Final question. What surprised you? Was there one great surprise that you came across in your research for this book?
The early years were a bit surprising at how difficult they were and how many sacrifices had to be made by Conwell and Laura Carnell. Laura Carnell was Russell Conwell's right-hand person and was, well, she was the only person ever to hold the title associate president. She basically could do all that needed to be done as president, as Conwell's assistant. But those sacrifices and the many financial exigencies that beset the university from time to time. I've kiddingly said that the subtitle of the book ought to be One Damn Financial Crisis After Another. But in the early years, I was surprised to see at some instances how Conwell just struggled and struggled to make ends meet. At one point, he offered to rename the university Bucknell University in Philadelphia if William Bucknell would pay off our debt as he had for the little college up in Lewisburg. And he offered to sell it to the state. He offered to sell it to the city. We had an enormous debt of over $300,000, which he, in 1910-1911, it was insurmountable. And he offered to sell the whole institution to the state. Instead, the state began to provide a biennial appropriation, which helped. It was not nearly enough to cover all of the costs. And we became state-aided between 1911 and 1965, and then state-affiliated in 1965 and have since. But even that has brought financial crisis in 1977 when the Commonwealth General Assembly couldn't decide on an appropriation. And, of course, just this past year, the General Assembly deadlocked again and refused for nearly 6 months to appropriate money to the state-affiliated universities. So the goal, if you would, and the big surprise that comes to my mind, and I have grown up and attended state-supported institutions all my life, and I think it is that Temple, if it really wants to think about a next 125 years, it has to become more independent. It has to find its own way. It has to get those alums out there. I think we have to provide the cushion. I think that every graduate of Temple has to understand that some sacrifice was required to get them through, and whatever they could do to help others coming along would not only be appreciated, but I think just be absolutely necessary as we go forward into this century.
James Hilty, Temple University, 125 years of service to Philadelphia, the nation, and the world, is out now on Temple Press. One of the myths of the American Revolution is that every Philadelphian was a loyal patriot. In reality, many supported King George III, especially when the British Army occupied Philadelphia from 1777 to 78. Now WRTI's Tom Keels looks back at how local Tories collaborated with British soldiers to throw the biggest, gaudiest party this city has ever seen, the notorious Mischianza.
In May 1778, the British Army had occupied Philadelphia for nearly 9 months, but their hold on the capital of the rebellious colonies was loosening. After a rough winter at Valley Forge, George Washington's Continental Army was ready to fight again. In Paris, King Louis XVI had pledged French support for the American cause. Kerry Dethorne, chief curator at Independence National Historical Park, sees 1778 as the beginning of the end for Great Britain.
Within a few months, the worm had sort of turned, and the fortunes of the British Army fell when Washington was able to remobilize. And they said, look, we got to get out of Philadelphia. We got to go up to New York City, where we have a stronghold, and it's much safer for us.
When General William Howe, head of the British Army in America, was relieved of his command, British officers used his departure as an excuse for a going-away gala. John Andre, Howe's aide-de-camp, devised a magnificent, if oddly named, celebration, says Laura Keim, curator at Stenton and Wick in Germantown.
Andre picked the name Mischianza. It comes from two Italian words that mean to mix and to mingle. And perhaps that's part of the motivation, mixing with the natives and mingling with the natives while you can.
The priorities of the British look a bit skewed today. It's as if the U.S. Army marked the collapse of South Vietnam in 1975 not with a mad dash to helicopters atop the American embassy, but with a blowout bash at the Saigon Hilton. But Kerry Dethorne sees a method in the Britons' seeming madness.
So they decided, oh, we're not going out in the cover of darkness. We're not going out, you know, with a whimper. We're going out with a bang. And so they put this party together, and its theme was almost like a medieval pageant or tournament. And their attempt to kind of put a smiley face on the fact that the British Army was being kicked out of Philadelphia.
On May 18, 1778, the Mischianza commenced with a flotilla that carried British officers down the Delaware River. Accompanying them were hundreds of guests from the city's most distinguished families. Philip Seitz, curator of history at Clifton, sees their presence as a symbol of Revolutionary America's political rupture.
There are a lot of people who are undecided, and there are a lot of people who are still loyal to the king, who feel that revolution, in fact, is too far for America to go. And in fact, some of the leading families of Philadelphia go over to the British side and serve in some offices under the British to help administer Philadelphia while the troops are in the city.
The regatta landed at Walnut Grove, a country estate at what is now Wharton Street in South Philadelphia. There, 14 British officers led by John Andre fought a mock joust. Carrie Dethorn feels that it must have made for an odd spectacle.
They even had knights and their ladies, and it couldn't have been more absurd.
The British knights were fighting for the favors of 14 aristocratic American girls like Peggy Shippen and Peggy Chu. These Mischianza maidens constituted Philadelphia's social A-list. They were the 18th-century equivalents of Edie Sedgwick or even Paris Hilton. All were attired in Oriental-style gowns and turbans designed by the ever-present John Andre. Laura Kime believes that these exotic costumes helped to transform the young ladies of Philadelphia into a harem for British officers.
The women wearing Turkish dress to me is just highly symbolic of the British view of America as a colonial place, and women in particular as a kind of colonial commodity.
After the tournament ended in a tie, the guests retired to a nearby mansion for dancing and a supper consisting of over 1,000 different dishes. The Mischianza's 14 hours of revelry were followed by a long hangover. Less than a month later, the British evacuated Philadelphia for New York, accompanied by 3,000 loyalists fearful of retribution. But most of the Mischianza maidens and their families elected to remain in Philadelphia and face the music. According to Carrie Dethorn, this music turned out to be surprisingly sweet.
And you wonder, well, after the Mischianza, those women must have been just pariahs. I mean, people must have said, well, you participated in that, you know, effete event, and we never want to speak to you again, which is not the case at all. The women who were part of that event were, after the Mischianza, went right back to their social status that they had before the event.
Most of the Mischianza maidens married prominent men and became pillars of the new American aristocracy, which emerged after the Revolution. Peggy Chu, one of John Andre's conquests, wed war hero John Eager Howard, later governor of Maryland. Peggy made the mistake of telling a friend, in front of her husband, that Andre was a most witty and cultivated gentleman. Governor Howard promptly bellowed,
"He was a damn spy, sir. Nothing but a damn spy."
The multi-talented Andre did indeed become a spy. In 1779, he persuaded Benedict Arnold, commander of West Point, to surrender the garrison to the British. But the plot was discovered in time, and Andre was executed. Arnold escaped to England with his wife, the former Peggy Shippen, another of Andre's old flames. To this day, historians argue whether this Mischianza maiden masterminded the plot between her husband and ex-lover, which almost sabotaged American independence.
WRTI's Tom Keels with the first of a five-part series called Wicked Philadelphia, which we'll be running over the coming weeks. A companion book to these features is out now on the History Press imprint. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milanoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.